There will be some people, Stephen, who will be watching this interview. He's saying that and think you sound like a great patriotic guy. They'll also see you in Moscow and being very complimentary about Vladimir Putin, who many Americans believe fixed the US election, which is why Donald Trump became president.
For anyone to think that Vladimir Putin had anything to do with fixing the elections, or even that the Russians have that kind of technology, is stupid.
Welcome, listeners of Chapo Trap House, and our great Vladimir Putin, one of the best leaders in the world, according to our good friend of the show, Steven Seagal.
This one, motherfucker, Vladimir Putin's what I like to call motherfucking world leader of influence.
Steven Seagal, if you guys didn't see it, in the previous clip, he's coming out against the kneeling protests in the NFL, and people don't know this about Seagal. He has claimed to have been a CIA operative for like 3 decades now.
Yes.
So he's like, you know, as someone who was the top of the sniper program and the best assassin, this insults me.
No, he actually said, I've risked my life countless times for that flag. And that's insane that he just... Nobody challenges him. I mean, if you really care about the flag and people stealing valor and being disrespectful, let's talk about this fucking potato with a goatee lying about being an operator.
He sacrificed his twin brother's life in a perfect weapon for that flag.
He did. His website claims that he is the only civilian to ever dismantle an atomic bomb.
Oh, he's so fucking good.
I mean, if we're gonna have a story about kneeling, disrespecting the flag, stealing valor, and Steven Seagal, you know we're gonna lead with it.
Steven Seagal would never sit or kneel when he should stand. That's one thing I've learned from his movies.
Yeah, he definitely is always standing. Yeah. That's the one thing we know about.
Very mobile guy.
He's very agile, very mobile. He definitely would be able to get on one knee and then get back up again without any trouble.
Yeah, that's the real.
Can you imagine the clicking that you would hear on the way
grinding
down?
Grinding noise like a fucking washing machine as he tried to get on his knee.
It sounds like getting a laundry bag full of Chiclets caught in a door. Just trying to slam it over and over again. I like that he switched countries because he's like, oh, you can sometimes be prosecuted for sex crimes in America.
Well, that is the funny thing about Steven Seagal putting these pampered athletes in their place for disrespecting America, which, you know, I'm all for.
He's
right to do that. Like, they are right to disrespect the flag and our troops, but
absolutely.
I don't think Steven Seagal, like I said, someone who literally has renounced his U.S. citizenship so he can do more sex crimes in Russia, is really the person
but
to be bringing that message.
You forget about that atomic bomb that he dismantled,
right.
And he That's wants right. to be respected for that, for all
well,
times.
Well, and he was a blue life for a while. He had that show
right.
about
Law
it.
Man,
it was great.
He was a blue life, and he mattered. He was an orange life.
He mattered
life.
More than anyone else.
He had a reddish-orange life.
He had, what did he call it? He said, like, copdar or something, or some cop instinct.
Vision.
He's like, oh, I can sense certain things, and he thinks he has, like, you know, some sort of premonition of crime, and it's just racial profiling.
Yeah. I just
he would just be like, this guy over here looks a little suspicious, and it's just a black guy.
You can sense something about trafficked him. Moldovan woman within 100 yards.
Through echolocation, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I shouldn't before the show gets too far gone, I should say we're going to be speaking to Tim Faust in a little bit, and also welcome Amber back to the show.
I'm back.
Back from the jolly old UK, where you had a chance to go. You'll be writing about that, and we'll talk about that in a future episode for sure.
Yes.
But, like I said, the fact that Steven Seagal is back in the news is... Someone put together a very nice compilation of some of his greatest hits, and I have to credit Burgoon M Matt on Twitter, who put together this thread, including he taught me something about Seagal, which is that one of Seagal's songs that he recorded in his music career was called Lady Saw Me Want the Punani. So Steven Seagal has recorded a song called Me Want the Punani, which I'd like to just play. Ooh, is that Tim?
It's our neighbor.
Okay, just play a little clip now from Me Want the Punani by Steven Seagal.
Have you heard this yet?
I have not.
Oh, you're in. Mr. Steven Seagal, right on my job, me a kind of same one. What is y'all? So I'm standing for Lee and the sock. I have done no more wrong. You see me? So.
Girl, would you really want, darling? I want you for me. Wow. Make me feel nice. Why? Tell me what you really want. All night. Me want the Punani. See for me, my name. Okay, you can't see it, but right now Matt is daggering on the table.
Steven Seagal has cut a number of albums.
Yeah,
I think the first and still best is Songs from the Crystal Cave.
Amazing.
But on his follow-up album, Mojo Priest, I wasn't so familiar with. And the track listing for Mojo Priest is really something, and I just want to go through it now with you guys. Track one is called Somewhere in Between. Track two is called Love Doctor. Track three is called Dark Angel. Then comes Gunfire in a Juke Joint. Next, we have My Time is Numbered, which is an odd name for a song.
Not an expression.
Days are numbered.
Very good at words.
Not making this up, track six is called Alligator Ass.
Just a sexy, scaly ass that's been around for 500 million years.
Track seven,
I'm here to fuck it.
And track seven is called BBQ. A tribute to barbecue food.
Barbecue food.
If you're a fan of the show, you must like barbecue food as well. Track eight called Hoochie Coochie Man. That's a little like, you know, a little punani there as well. Again, not making this up, track nine is called Talk to My Ass.
That sounds like a song Felix wrote. Yeah.
Track ten called Dust My Broom.
No. That's an old
Dust My Broom.
That's an old blues thing.
Okay. Yeah, he's just like, this is like white man blues.
You think Hoochie Coochie Man is like the cover?
I think that might be a Muddy Waters cover, yeah.
Yeah.
Track 11 is called Slow Boat to China. Next track is this is problematic. This track is called She Dat Pretty.
Oh, dude, come on.
Is she better?
Yeah. That pretty. So, again, that's Stephen flexing his AAVE. Yeah.
I'm the motherfucking editor of Mother Jones.
and then the last two tracks, Red Rooster closing it out with Shake.
So, yeah, half of these sound like standards. Yeah.
I think for part of this, he was doing his food order, and that's why there's a Shake and Barbecue on there.
One last selection here from Burgoon. Matt was aware of this, but this was from when Steven Seagal had to end his ill-fated A&E series Lawman because of allegations of sexual harassment and sex trafficking. This came out in open court.
You can't do those unless you've been elected sheriff.
I'm just reading from the news account here. It says, the lawsuit says Wynn told Seagal that she had to leave to meet with family members who would be suspicious if she didn't show up. Nonetheless, he told her not to leave the house and followed her with a gun equipped with a flashlight. I mean, he's an operator. If you have a flashlight, you need a gun to go with it.
Who else loved guns with flashlights on them? The Zodiac Killer.
Also true.
Yeah, but also Splinter Cell.
So she says, followed her with a gun equipped with a flashlight as she went out to a waiting cab, which sped away as she jumped in the front seat. Wynn's lawsuit said she could identify, quote, a unique physiological reaction that Seagal had to sexual arousal, which could be corroborated by the other attendants, and that's in quotes.
So it's not a boner.
The suit did not specify what that reaction is.
Sometimes when I be getting real randy, my bow tie spins around.
Sometimes my motherfucking tongue rolls out and then snaps back in like a motherfucking windshade.
Thing is, when you study in the East, you don't be running like a normal person. Your legs move so fast that they resemble wheels on a car, but it takes about 3 seconds for them to start moving on the ground. That's just a little thing called Tai Chi.
True motherfucking operators, when they get their blood up, their heart jumps out of their chest in the perfect shape of a cartoon heart.
All right, we gotta stop.
We could literally do this all
yeah.
day.
Yeah, enough
serious stuff is over.
Enough serious stuff. Let's do the stupid, let's have some silly, fun. Let's have some fun, the silly part of the show. Yeah. But before we bring on Tim Faust, I gotta do a quick plug, quick show business. Next week in Los Angeles, the City of Angels, Chapo Goes Hollywood at LA Podfest on Friday night.
Woo!
So just like plug again for LA Podfest, Chapo Trap House.
Log on to LAPodFest.com for tickets.
Yes, LAPodFest.com, Chapo Trap House, making our West Coast debut at LA Podfest on Friday, October 6th. Yes. Check the website for further details, information in the show information. Okay, we'll be back in a second with Tim Faust.
Just talking to the microphone here, having a great time.
Having a regular time with my friends.
Normal time. I listened to a liberal podcast the other day, The Humorous.
We were just talking about that. Tim. So can I ask you about that on the show? Or are you sick of thinking about it?
It's funny as hell.
I don't think we should name them because I don't want to just be beating up someone else's horrible podcast.
But
the podcast
harassment.
Was maybe one of the worst things I've ever seen. I've heard.
The male host, the male co-host, who spoke only when spoken to, spent about 40 seconds trying to get the word clit out of his mouth. He was like, and the Bernie Bros were harassing her, and they said they were thinking with their... God, I don't want to say it. And the host, was like, well, what were they saying? I don't know what it is. Ass? Which I thought was a gag, but no, she didn't get what he was going to say next. He's like, begins with a C. It's the pleasure button.
Oh man.
Spit that clit out of your mouth.
It was, I mean, like, I understand not wanting to say like the slur. I understand that when recording.
I don't think clit is a slur.
Clit isn't a slur. Like,
you know that guy don't eat pussy.
They didn't even say gash or anything. Right. That's some really nasty.
Right. That was the best part. He was too timid to say clit. And I thought, oh man, he doesn't want to say clit.
Wait a second. If he was going to be like a good ally, he shouldn't be intimidated by any part of female anatomy as long as you're using the correct, you know, terminology.
Yeah, he'd be like, Steven Seagal and be praising the punani.
Yeah. Me want the punani.
Me want to argue with Tim Faust. Bumba blood clot hide amendment, it don't matter.
This is Steven Seagal's new song where he's for improving Obamacare with bipartisan solutions.
So
market solutions.
I want to get to
Jamaican the compromise.
We'll get to Bernie's plan and the Hyde Amendment and the most humorless podcast in history in a second. But I think first, you guys want to talk about being on the call?
Yeah.
How should I introduce that? Or do you want to introduce it?
That's fine.
Okay.
You can introduce it, then I'll talk about it.
Okay. All right. So Tim and Amber, you guys were just on a secret call.
Yeah, it was so secret. There were like 500 people on it. And it was broadcast.
And recorded and publicly available.
Yeah.
Really good OPSEC.
There's 500 people on one phone call?
Yeah, well, they set it up to where... some kind of software where you can have like a million observers.
Wow.
Chatterbait.
We use Chatterbait.
That's like the Al-Qaeda conference call. Shout out Eli Lake.
Eli.
Big scoop there. Excellent scoop. Excellent
big
reporting
scoop
by him.
Big salad.
But seriously though, this was like a DSA like strategy call or what, planning session about healthcare?
Right. It was about the Medicare for All campaign. It's, you know, in the early stages, but it's moving along really quickly. Dino Guastella set it up, and I've been working with Dino and Melissa Naschek on sort of creating a campaign in a box, and sort of spearheaded by a canvassing campaign. So I've been reaching out to Bernie and Corbyn canvassers, who are oftentimes the same people. Corbyn actually brought in a lot of Bernie canvassers to work on the campaign. And we've been sort of trying to develop or at least, you know, fit the canvassing model that they've used to a more, you know, campaign, healthcare campaign rather than candidate campaign based canvassing model. We're also sort of, we want to include events in it as well, which would be essential for people living in rural areas where canvassing may not be as you know, as viable so that you could reach out and to the National and they could, you know, hook you up with a speaker and, you know, you can set up an event for the community in like a church or whatever, Moose Lodge or whatever, and they can send, you know, someone from maybe Physicians for National Healthcare or a labor campaign for single payer. And right now we're sort of in beta testing for the canvassing model in Philly and East Bay. We're trying out different wraps and seeing what works.
You mean actual wraps, like when you knock on someone's door and you're like, hey, I'm from PRSA and I'm here to say?
And then we flip the chair around. And then you sit in it the wrong way so that people know you're serious.
You gotta turn that hat around, too.
Yeah, you gotta flip the hat around.
Yo, kids, you know what really whips scrot? Universal healthcare.
But yeah, the idea is that, you know, when we sort of get this data back and see what works, we'll have like official DSA campaign materials so that any chapter can call in and say, hey, I want a canvas. And we can send you someone probably from initially the Bernie or the Corbyn campaign to train a room of people on how to knock on doors. We can send you all the official materials. And, you know, we could just hit the ground running. And I will talk about this, you know, later when I write my report on this. But I just got back from UK again. And honestly, like, you forget that they're living under a right-wing government right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so on the move and they're so ready and they could be under a right-wing government for quite some time and it's shitty and there are attacks on their NHS and education and it's a terrible austerity government, but they're so optimistic and they're so just working on these projects. And I think Naomi Klein said it really well last week. It's not just enough to fight Trump. We have to actually be working on projects. Trump is not going to be president forever.
When she said that on our show first, not at the labor conference. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, she got the big gig of headlining the labor conference after they saw that she did our show.
Yeah. But Tim was also on the call. And yeah. And it went really well. People were really excited. People are really excited to canvas and stuff now.
It's really fun. I mean, canvas. If you want to win, you need to canvas. If you don't want to canvas, you don't want to win.
There's just no substitute.
It's fun, you know, but I prefer to burlap.
By the way, if
I prefer muslin.
Just a little bit, though, if we're going to be like training people how to knock on doors, you know, a little tip for all the canvassers out there. Here's a little something I do.
Ooh.
That's right, you're building rapport.
Yeah, that's a baller move.
It's going to take about 2 weeks of my Menaker intensive knocking on doors, canvassing conference strategy session. It's $400 a day, right to Will Menaker, care of Large Sons Productions at our new P.O. box. But, you know, I'll be teaching. It's a nonprofit now. We have a new nonprofit wing for tax purposes. But I'll be teaching people how to knock on doors. Like I said, 2 week course, $400 a session. Attendance is required if you like want to be a member of the show, if you want to keep subscribing to the show.
Is this a paid episode or a free episode?
Free.
Well, then you gotta bleep out what you just did because you're just giving away like that was a. I owe you $100 right now. Like that was.
Well, Kim,
But Amber, sorry, going off what you said, like you just came back from the UK. They are still under an austerity government, but you're seeing an incredible amount of enthusiasm and optimism about the people who are fighting back.
Right? I mean, they're working.
How can we bring that to this country? How can we bring it? Did you find the same level of excitement around this issue of Medicare for All?
I mean, there is now. The thing is, you just literally have to give people something to do.
We'll get them there.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, as soon as they, you know, hung up all the comments, they did like a survey after the call and they're like, yeah, we want a canvas. So hopefully that should be rolling out pretty soon.
I mean, the fight for universal healthcare contains within it all the other parallel fights of the big thing that we know is bad that is fucking everything over, but it's hard to name, right? Like the big structures of things that fuck us over. And here's a tangible way to organize your neighborhood and fight back. And like not just fight back and end at the point of resistance, but push forward, like Naomi Klein said, to create something better, create something bigger. Like instituting, like... I am absolutely convinced that American health, like America has all of the ingredients to have like the best healthcare program in the entire world, full stop. And I think going for anything shorter than that is inambitious. And I'm excited by it. And so what I'll be doing is I'm going around, I'm doing 25 talks in the next 2 months. Oh boy. Trying to get folks, one, like talk about what is single payer, what is a single payer healthcare model, what is universal healthcare, why do we need these things, what do they mean, like what are all the concepts kind of bundled in the idea of health justice, and then two, why should we how do we together achieve it? And I think the canvas model that we talked about in the DSA call is absolutely the way to get that. Because the reason people are, like, people are often afraid to, like, knock on doors, which is wrong. Like, the reason you're afraid to knock on doors is because you are told to be afraid of your neighbor, and we have all these artificial divides between us and the people that live literally next to us who are most affected by the same things we're affected by.
Yeah, I have not been killed by my neighbors once.
Right.
So why should I fear knocking on
doors? I've got 100% zero kill record.
Yeah, totally.
My KDA is fantastic. Yeah.
Women, I'm normal. Let me come in and tell you about healthcare. I'm only canvassing women.
Because they are most affected by lack of healthcare.
Yeah, and by not knowing that I'm normal.
I feel really good about it, right? And so the call, Amber talked a lot about her, what she was seeing in the UK, which made me really, really happy. I saw a piece a couple days ago in some... a friend of the show, I think, Abby Wilkinson, posted a piece that she saw about some... super right-wing rag in the UK. Positing.
All of them.
Well, yeah. Yes. Jez is going to be...
Lad? Was it Lad? Or was it Lad?
I think...
It was rude.
Yeah. Oh, no, I actually... You guys are both wrong. It was actually a council fannies.
It was the ruddy gentleman.
It was about how Jez is going to be PM and we're just... And the Tories are just letting him because they're scared. Even though they're in power, they think they're on their heels. And that was pretty cool. If I ever read a piece like that in the U.S., that'll be a reason to fucking have a beer. That'll be really exciting. But no, I think the work deal, like, there's a lot of organizations that have been working on this for decades, and their work is really important, and I think we're building off of that in a way that's really energizing and really compelling.
And we've had representatives from labor and from the physicians. Like, we really do have a really solid grounding in the people that have already been working on this for a long time. All they need is the canvassing army.
Right. We're building a broad coalition armed with both popular support and a moral imperative.
How tied is this canvassing effort to the bill that is currently being proposed by Bernie Sanders?
It's cool.
Is that the template that you guys are going off of when you knock on doors?
Actually, we thought about this pretty heavily because we do like the Bernie bill, especially after some pressure from the physicians. He sort of expanded it and included... a few notes about coverage for all residents. But the truth of the matter is, and I don't want to suck all the air out of the room, but that bill might fail. Like any number of bills might fail. And so we need to have a campaign that is actually based on principles rather than a single bill, especially right now under Donald Trump. So we had like a 5-point principle-based campaign that could be plugged onto any bill as it goes. First one was it's a single program, not a patchwork. Second one, it's comprehensive coverage, inpatient, outpatient, dental, reproductive, everything. Three, free at the point of service, no fees, no co-pays, nothing. Four, universal coverage, that means like non-citizens, means residents too. And five, a jobs replacement program for the transition.
So anyone in the health insurance who loses their job, you're going to like retrain,
the CEO of Blue Cross, the ones we don't drag to the guillotine.
I mean, it's a relatively small number of people, right? Like Bruning put together his estimate of how many people are actually affected by if insurance companies disappeared tomorrow, like what does that industry look like? Because often like opponents of a single payer program.
There was an article that was written the other week that was like, you know, proponents of single payer healthcare might be interested to learn that the healthcare industry employs a lot of low income women.
Yeah, that thing pisses me off so fucking much.
Do you want to take away their shitty, terrible jobs?
That thing pisses me off so fucking much because the implication is the insurance industry is just giving them jobs because they think it's good to do.
Right.
And it's like, they're going to automate those jobs as soon as they fucking can, you piece of shit.
Your employer is waiting to fuck you over.
Yeah.
Yeah, and anyone who like studies any kind of feminist economics knows that expanding the public sector is the best feminist jobs program there is. And that is what this will have to do.
Do you realize that the Pinkertons employ the lowest of the Irish? Yeah. You realize you're hurting them.
That's redundant. So,
Brunig posits that there's a couple hundred thousand people tops that are affected by this changeover. And so there's two things. One, the American economy churns about 1 million people per month, people that are either laid off or quit their job or retire. So like it's within those parameters. And two, Bernie's bill, I think it is very very strongly, allocates up to 1% of the transition period's budget into building programs to retrain people, take care of them. It's called fair. It's called just transition. It's good. Like, obviously, we're all workers. Watch everybody's back. But it's not like the fucking, like, it's not like this, oh, we secretly, we gotcha. Here's the Achilles heel of the program. Come on.
Well, I mean, the thing that does concern me, though, is Bernie's proposal that would require federally a mandate for all Swedes to smile.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm very pro the sort of expansion of reproductive health, but I'm anti having to show the feeties.
It's not right.
Amber, so Amber's point about, like, we want to push not for an individual bill but for a broader movement is spot on. This is not a one-year canvas. This is not for a single candidate. At the same time, like, this bill I think is pretty good. One of the things I'm doing when I go around talking to local organizations are, like, everybody should organize on this, like, principles-based framework. Talk to somebody, ask them, what's the deal with your healthcare? People love to talk about how they're being fucked over by their insurer, by the hospital, by their employer. You can talk to people and, like, you fucking build community with people around you. Once you have them on board for, like, here's this vision of this thing that they want, like, the actual ask itself can change based on where you are. One of the things that the New York City chapter, DSA, Socialist Feminist Working Group, put together was the idea of enrolling folks at the door on Medicaid if they're eligible. There's millions of folks that are eligible but not enrolled in Medicaid. Like, there's, like, Medicaid isn't the answer, but, like, enrolling your neighbor who is eligible in Medicaid is a great way to, like, help somebody out. If you're in a state where you've got one senator that endorsed Bernie's bill or one rep that endorsed Connor's bill but others haven't, you can lobby them to endorse the movement or sign, like, a Norquist-like pledge saying that they will back a federal single payer. You can tailor the individual ask based upon your context. I really, really want to learn what those contexts are across the U.S. because the situation of fighting for healthcare in Kansas City and Iowa City and Minneapolis and Western Connecticut are all very, very, very different. And I want to learn what that looks like. But building the community and building that relationship and building that unilateral demand for universal single-payer healthcare is what will get us through the next 6 years.
We're going to talk about it a little bit with the CHIP expiring, but it's kind of interesting. I mean, Amber brought up how in the UK, like, they're under a brutally austere and terrible right-wing government, but there's all this energy. And there have been sustained attacks on the NHS from both parties there for many years. But it is kind of interesting how they're able to rally defense for a program that is universal, is directly visible in their lives, compared to, you know, how ridiculous is it that we have CHIP, this thing that gives millions of kids health insurance, has probably saved tons of lives, but it has an expiration date, that we have these solutions that are sort of sticking our fingers in the dams of a market that can never work because the problem is the market, that have all these timetables, that have all these expiration dates that are conditional on a bunch of shit.
Kids might stop getting sick.
That's true. We have said the problems are going to stop. So you're right,
yeah. I'm banking on you for that one. No, you're right. Like, one of the...
Sorry, real quick. What is CHIP and what would it... Like, it's going to be... It's going to expire. They're going to allow it to expire. First of all, could you explain what it is?
Right. So CHIP is a supplementary health insurance program for low-income kids. Low-income kids means under 200% of the federal poverty level.
Not seeing a lot of winners there.
Right.
I think this bill is, you know, I don't know. I think it should be allowed to.
Low energy kids.
Yeah.
It covers right now, I think, 9 million kids. Back in 1997, 23% of low-income kids were without health insurance entirely. And one really pernicious thing that I actually have a piece coming out in Jacobin, I think tomorrow, that I mentioned this on, is that, like, America has a specific perversity, a specific disease where we conflate the idea of insurance and the idea of healthcare. We kind of use those things unilaterally because in America, your access to getting help is dependent upon your ability to pay. And so, like, there's like a CHIP provides health insurance for kids, but CHIP also provides a lot of models for prenatal care. It has a Strong Start program where women that are or people that are pregnant that are marginalized and, like, are in trouble can go to wait. It offers, like, a social work model of prenatal care, which is super fucking good. Like, there's one of the biggest successes I think of CHIP is this prenatal care model. There was this myth for a long time, the idea of the crack baby, that poor women were most of the women of color were smoking crack, and therefore their kids were being born with deformities, were being born early. Wrong. Like, smoking crack is probably not great for a fetus, but it's less bad than smoking cigarettes. The problem was lead paint in the walls. People are being pregnant and people are being born in substandard housing, and that's with bad nutrition, and that's fucking them up, right?
By the way, side note, there are still tons of apartments in New York full of lead paint.
I'm pretty sure I live in one of them, yeah, so that's pretty good.
Well, don't get pregnant.
Yeah, I'm trying my best. We have this idea in America of like separating the worthy from the unworthy poor. The idea that somewhere out there, someone is getting a free ride. And because this person might exist, and if they do, I don't give a shit, fuck it. But because this person might exist, we need to like build this super complicated patchwork of programs, which creates gaps through which people like poor kids can fall through. And so CHIP was created to try to like staple a canvas over one of those gaps, one of those biggest gaps. It is a discretionarily funded bill, which means its funding is up for debate every couple of years. It was reauthorized in 2009, 2013, 2015. So it has not like a they haven't been funding it for like a long term plan because it's been like a little volleyball. And the most recent reconciliation period ended without a CHIP reauthorization. So under the current funding proposal, funding will run out by the end of the year. And because this is a program that's split. It's a block grant, although it's a different kind of block grant than like the Graham Cassidy shit. This is a block grant that the feds have often pumped more money into when it was running at deficits, because taking care of people that are poor, people that are sick, isn't profitable. Because it is a block grant, states are on the hook for a large part of the funding. And because of that, a lot of states are now, I think Utah was the first one out of the gates, are now filing to scale back their enrollments, create more impositions for receiving care, or ultimately withdraw entirely from the CHIP program. It's really fucked up. And I was talking to my partner this morning about, like, was this a problem of malevolence or a problem of incompetence? And fundamentally, I think the answer is it doesn't matter. To so nakedly devalue the lives of 9 million kids. I mean, fundamentally, this is an act of class war and an act of race war, right? This is explicitly hurting poor kids, and mostly poor kids of color, poor families of color. This is explicitly an act of race and class war. And so whether they just couldn't get it in time because they were too busy jerking off about Cassidy Graham, or whether they actively planned not to do this. Although Orrin Hatch, who wrote the bill with Ted Kennedy, and some assistance from Hillary Clinton.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, Hillary Clinton, my mother. Orrin Hatch said that, like, oh, there's a deal coming through. They're going to pass it. It can be a 5-year extension or whatever. But, like, I don't fucking care. Where is it? Well, like, they're now, like, it's enough to, like, it reminds me of, like, the fucking, like, DACA rollback, right? Now you've got a bunch of kids that are, like, living in fear of being deported or having their families harmed. Now you've got a bunch of kids that are living in fear of, like, not being able to get healthcare, not being able to pay for healthcare. You've got parents that have to fucking be afraid for their kids' lives. Even if kids do get insurance through the ACA, which is one of the proposals to kind of solve in the interim, they're going to get higher risk of preventable disease, lower standard of living, and they're still vulnerable to all this shit that happens around them, all these social determinants that make health worse. And pregnant people are going to fucking suffer worst of all. It's abominable. And I don't know why it didn't pass. This is a gimme. Everyone looks good when you pass CHIP. It's passed with bipartisan support every time it's come up. So I don't know why this happened, but it's like in a year of naked betrayals of government responsibility to people, this is another one of them. I don't know if it's the most naked, because there's a lot of bad shit's happened. Puerto Rico's happening at the same time. But there is no mitigation of this. If they pass another bill tomorrow to fund it, the fact that it took that long is still an abomination. I'm pretty mad about
it. Well, that's just it. They're all part of the same thing. This is they're field testing the new model whereby they're rolling back the number of people who are going to count as full citizens who are owed anything, because they see something coming on the horizon in terms of catastrophic climate change and lack of resources, and they know that it's going to get to be lifeboat time, and they want to keep that boat as small as possible Senator from my former state, my home state of Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, was speaking to a group of students.
Oh, that was amazing. We should put in the audio for that. It's short and brutal.
Do you personally consider healthcare as a privilege or a right?
I think it's probably more of a privilege. Do you consider food a right? Do you consider clothing a right? Do you consider shelter a right? What we have as rights is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Past that point, you know, we have the right to freedom. Past that point, everything else is a limited resource that we have to use our opportunities given to us so that we can afford those things. So
look, healthcare, housing, food, these are not rights. These are privileges. And they are scarce resources, and they go to the people who deserve them. And that is basically tautologically defined as the people who can already afford them.
Ron Johnson inherited a fucking used car dealership, if I recall correctly, right? Wasn't that his
He married into a rich family from a woman he met in college and then got money to start a construction business from his in-laws.
Right.
Anton Chigurh voice. You married into
it's
it?
It's literally the all in the family joke.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the health scare update for this week. But before we move on to our reading series to round out the show, Tim, plug away.
Yeah, sweet. First off, Bernie's bill is a thing that exists that warrants a lot of discussion. I have a piece coming out in Jacobin tomorrow where I go through it thoroughly. I also have a new podcast that me and my partner Kelly Jo put together. She's a healthcare lawyer, and all the smart things that I say are just things that she texts me before I say them. We have a podcast called Heavy Medical where we go through a white paper on healthcare policy, a current issue in healthcare policy, and a metal album that we both like. And so in the past week, we went through fetal protection laws, which are extremely heinous. There are ways to, for example, if it turns doctors into cops, they might drug test a woman if she or a pregnant person if they show signs of having a drug in the system. That person then goes to jail and is shackled while they give birth for attempted feticide. You have cases of people trying to kill them. Trying to get an abortion, not being able to get one, then being indicted for attempted feticide, trying to kill themselves, being locked up, forced to give birth, and then dying afterward. All the individual problems of patriarchal capitalism, misogyny, racism, transphobia, and basically when you don't have a robust healthcare state, the carceral state fills the gaps. Those all live within fetal protection laws. KJ has written a lot of research on it. We talk about that, and we go through Bernie's bill really, really thoroughly, both the good parts, the parts that need improvement, and then really what comes next. So it's called Heavy Medical.
What was the metal album, though?
Metal album this week was Kvelderlach's Knutsford, which is we have a no Nazis, no rapists policy, which is surprisingly difficult for metal music. this week's is Kvelderlach's Knutsford, which is a Norwegian kind of grungy or garagey metal band. I think it fucking kicks ass. They're very friendly and let us use their album on Facebook. Before that, it was Sacrilege, which is like a female-fronted Slayer from the 80s in the UK. Same time as Slayer, I think a little bit better. Before that was Cirith Ungol, which is extreme nerd shit. Music about wizards and fire and bullshit, and it was good as hell. So I've got that. It's good. We recently beat out Politico's Nerd Podcast, whatever the fuck it's called, Nerdcast.
Most
the
popular
charts.
Podcast for
we beat
killers.
Them. Number 98 motherfuckers compared to the 102. So we're their bosses now. And my only goal is to grind them into dust and fucking snort lines of their broken bodies. So I've got that going on. And then also, I'm hitting the road, as I said before. If you live anywhere between New York City, Lexington, Kentucky, Minneapolis, or Boston, kind of in that rhombus, I might be in your city in the next 3 months. So come talk about healthcare with me. It'll be fun.
Just, you know, Tim, if you're looking for music done by, you know, black metal done by like a good regular guy, there's this guy I like, Varg Verkens. Regular
guy.
Dude.
Great
fits your criteria.
Guy.
Yeah, normal guy. Good habits.
Yeah.
All right. Tim, will you stick around for this week's reading series?
It'd be my honor and pleasure.
It is a doozy.
Strength and honor, friend.
Fantastic.
This week's reading series, I'm doing all of it because it really requires all of it. It's not just going to be selections from. I'm going to now torture all of you. Matt, take an Ativan right now.
Oh,
because
no. Is this what I think it is?
Yes.
Oh, dear God.
I'm torturing
Matt,
my co-host.
Quaaludes in your water.
Oh, fuck.
I'm torturing all my co-hosts yet again because we are returning to Ms. Megan McArdle.
I knew it would be her. Oh, I fucking knew it. No. I fucking knew it.
Okay, guys. The last time we talked about...
We didn't choose this life, guys.
Oh. The last time she was on the show, we did a reading series from, I think... It was definitely her most evil column today.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You will remember that as the one in which she said, use the Grenfell Tower fire incident to say, basically, you can never blame landlords or lax regulations for an easily preventable disaster like this, because if things were different, the people might have died another way.
Yeah.
Right. That's not an exaggeration.
You can't prevent... building fires because they might kill baby Hitler. That is the article that nearly got me tased by campus security. It's
the libertarian butterfly effect.
Maybe, I don't know, like this one, for some reason.
I'm not going to get mad because it's not evil. It's just so banal and stupid.
The last one was her most evil column she's ever written. This one is the most pointless column ever written. Not just her, not the most pointless thing she's ever written. It may be the most pointless thing ever written by any human being.
She was paid to write this. We need to make that clear.
Bloomberg.
This isn't a Medium post. This isn't a Facebook wall thing. She got paid to write this.
Let's dive into this now, because this column is extraordinary. This is in the opinion section of Bloomberg View. Again, the title of the article by Megan McArdle is... Why is Italian food so amazing?
Oh my God.
Any of you know what baccalà is? Of course you don't. Well, it's salted cod. We taught the world how to eat.
I didn't.
You didn't. What?
Goes to Sparrow once.
People burning to death is a necessity for a free society. And also, let's talk nosh.
Okay. The subhead here is New Yorkers know. The rest of the U.S. deserves a taste of what the Italian diaspora brings with it, by Megan McArdle. And before I even begin, you know, I'm from New York. The show's based out of Brooklyn. There's a lot of good Italian food here. Listeners of the show elsewhere in the country, is there anywhere, broadly speaking, in America that Italian food hasn't penetrated yet?
No, dude.
Food?
Italian food.
Nah, dude.
I'm sorry. I was making a penetration joke.
Everywhere has like fine Italian cuisine. You got your Domino's. You got your Papa John's.
Olive Garden.
Subway.
Carrabba's.
I lived Fazoli's. In a really tiny little town, and the town outside of it had a small Italian-owned restaurant. Okay. I mean, like, they're a...
Yeah. That was in Indiana.
There's a smattering of people. All right. Yeah.
Like, so just like if you're listening to this now as a listener, you're not in New York or you're from, you know, another place in America that's maybe doesn't have as many Italians historically. Just think to yourself, like, is there an Italian restaurant near me? Is there an Italian deli?
Have I ever eaten Italian food?
And yeah. Good? Okay.
Spaghetti is one of the five basic kinds of food. Like, when I think of food, it's that and sandwiches.
Let's dive in. I'm going to read the whole thing because I don't want anything to go to waste here. Okay, Megan begins.
I'm going to lay down.
New York City, my birthplace.
1776.
New York City, my birthplace, is ringed by Italian neighborhoods. Go to Staten Island, to the Bronx, to Long Island, or to New Jersey. It doesn't matter where you go, as long as it's within 50 miles of the Empire State Building. Within that fortunate circle, you will find that you are always reasonably close to a neighborhood, or at least a street, full of little stores and restaurants of unprepossessing appearance and fantastic culinary achievement. Tragically, such neighborhoods are a blessing of erratic and patently unfair geographic distribution.
So she's talking about Stalin-style population transfers of Italians.
Matt, we'll get to that.
What I like to do is take the Italians and spread them all around.
We should keep them in Oblast.
Chef Spicy Meatballio, you didn't build that pizza. The government helped you.
The first thing we can sort of we're kind of see what's coming if you're familiar with McArdle, but the one sentence I want to highlight in the first paragraph is she says, it doesn't matter where you go, as long as you're within 50 miles of the Empire State Building. I don't know. There's just something about that phrase. I can't quite describe her writing,
It's so weird. Just, what is she even? And I mean, that's not even true. I mean, there is something called sort of the pizza belt, but it extends way up farther and farther north and south on the eastern seaboard.
I'm putting myself in the McCardle mindset, and I think when she wrote that sentence, she was imagining one of those Cold War era diagrams of what would happen if a hydrogen bomb exploded over Manhattan, and she was like, Italian food.
It's the chef in the pizza box kissing his finger. But it's just radiating outward, and it immediately stops when you get to central New Jersey.
Again, there's no time to spare. We have to do this whole thing. In the rest of the country, the quality of the prosciutto seems to be directly proportional to the number of handcrafted teak display cases and also to the elevation of your heart rate when you view the prices posted inside those cases.
What?
Sentence.
Wait, what's in
sentence?
I don't know what that sentence is.
Prose writing.
This is
writing style.
But okay, so she's saying that the prosciutto is proportionally to as good as nervous as you get
because it's expensive. It's expensive.
It's expensive.
That's what she's saying.
In Italian neighborhoods, by contrast, the older and more scuffed the linoleum, the barer the badly plastered walls, the more tattered the appearance of the single 1956 Mass card taped into the cash register by way of decoration, the more likely you are to discover the single best piece of charcuterie you have ever eaten.
You know what?
That was one sentence. That was one
sentence.
This lady,
she likes to talk about metrics and empiricism. I don't think that is an empirical claim she's making there.
I think she went to one restaurant. Again, adopting the McCardle mindset, she is thinking of one establishment in her head that she goes to. Okay.
And she's just, double fish cheap prosciutto.
It's like every time she presses her space key, like a little bit of ether blowing out into her face. And she's like, well, why have a period? Just keep going.
Unlike some enclaves that develop good restaurants and markets as they gentrify, Italians do not need to seek out good food as a way of expressing that they have arrived, financially and socially. Italians are already there. Socially.
Now that we have anything to say about it.
And being a cheerful and kind people, they are willing to invite the rest of us in.
Citation needed, people!
Hey. Okay, again, she's thinking of the pizza box.
The smiley, happy guy on the pizza box. Let's talk about fucking Officer Benevenstanciano when he caves in your fucking
guys,
trachea.
Guys, you think there's going to be some very, very broadly sketched ethnic stereotypes coming up? I don't know.
I'm so
let's check
ready.
It out.
I wish we had Racine on for this.
Oh, you're right.
I wish we had Racine for this right now.
You come with me. Come with Luigi. You don't want to sit with the rest of this scum.
Hey.
I only consider you scum compared to Krusty.
Oh, well, right.
I can see that. And I'll have the cannoli.
Yeah, you see how you scum.
I appreciated this anew while on vacation in Italy. Having spent years in a food desert of Washington, D.C., that's fucking true enough.
That is true, yeah.
Having had Boss Burger 50 times.
Dude, that's how she got this worldview, is by going to D.C. where, like, everyone just mumbles and you never get what you order and people ask confusing questions like, do you want brown sugar on your burger? It'll make you a libertarian.
She goes, I was practically weeping over the ease with which one could secure decent pizza. I am not the only American who have noticed that everything tastes better in Italy. And no, that's not just because you're on vacation and surrounded by charming ancient buildings. You may notice that few accounts of vacations in Reykjavik or Dublin begin with, the food was amazing. Quality of produce in Italy is, in fact, much better because Italians demand that it be better. And having gotten their hands on better ingredients, they prepare them with the care their treasures deserve.
So you're saying better ingredients mean better pizza? Yeah. Is that what she's saying? Yes,
that is, in fact,
she's getting paid thousands of dollars to write hundreds of words that boil down to better ingredients, better
Duce,
pizza.
Papa John.
I have to say, I don't ever want to be accused of defending D.C., but there is good food in D.C. It's just like Ethiopian or Yemeni.
Yeah, they have good Ethiopian food pretty well.
But they also didn't have that when Megan was growing up. Like,
she's from New York.
She just wants the acceptable people ethnic food.
This is just an obnoxious kid who came back from a study abroad and they'll only eat the food of the country they were just in. I can't.
By the way, I spell labor with a U now.
Yeah, exactly.
She continues. It's not clear why Italians have such an amazing array of exquisite regional dishes, nor why they have held out so fanatically against the blandifying forces of modern commercial food processing.
I support wholeheartedly as a libertarian.
We can guess that the Roman Empire probably had something to do with it. Empires facilitate trade in exotic foodstuffs, and rich imperial barons employ chefs who dedicate considerable ingenuity to finding the best possible uses of those ingredients.
During the Roman era, they didn't have tomatoes or pasta in Italy. What the fuck is she talking about?
Everyone in the Roman Empire drank like fucking a wine and berry and nut slurry for every meal and just ate handfuls of grain.
Their best condiment was fermented fish guts, and they had to dilute their wine with water.
Yep.
They were fucking dirt savages.
And if an empire encourages like culinary genius, that's why we have the famous English cuisine. Classics such as, you know, Sunday boil and
they used to eat swan, but only the queen was allowed to eat swan, and now it's legal. And like the racist thing that they say is all the Poles and Irish travelers are sneaking in and eating the swan. But I looked up like, oh, what does swan actually taste like? And like by all accounts, they stopped eating it because it tasted like shit. And the most consistent description I found was fishy mutton.
Delicious.
That sounds so good.
That's a pretty good Beatles song.
They didn't get the defining elements of Italian cuisine, tomatoes or pasta, until hundreds of years after the Roman Empire fell.
And again,
she is such a just a
also
dollar.
read the Jacobin piece, plea for culinary modernism. Everything we invented deliciousness like 80 years ago, and that's
she
it.
Knows,
everything before that sucks.
She knows nothing.
Well, this is what's funny about the first half of this paragraph, where she says, like, we can guess that the Roman Empire, like,
no,
she's,
we can't.
She's,
we kind of know that
well, no,
for
she's,
a fact.
She's guessing at this, but like there hasn't been like a probably 1,000 books
obviously
written on like the history of Italian food. She shows arguably the oldest cookbook in the world dates to the Roman Empire, and it is reasonable to suppose that after the empire collapsed, its culinary influence lingered among the citizenry.
There are literally Mesopotamian cookbooks. You fucking dumbass.
Nobody puts fermented fish guts on their food because of the Roman Empire.
Point to McArdle, she says in parentheses at the end of this paragraph, though it's worth noting that Italian cuisine as we know it today evolved with the arrival of new world foods like tomatoes.
But then, why make a paragraph before that if you're going to parenthetically destroy your entire premise?
Moving along. Next thing.
That is going to shit his pants.
Along.
The one you're not
going to
eat.
I wasn't. Just stupid shit about Italian food, but her just thundering idiocy is so infuriating.
Guys, a child has wandered into Matt's enclosure during the McArdle reading.
Our beautiful Harambe, we're going to have to put him down.
Just again, it's just every paragraph, it just switches gear. Another thought goes into her head. She's like, you know, it's reasonable for me to write this, is sort of what she's saying.
I
think she's on ketamine.
So she goes, a long growing season also helps. Without vegetables or abundant herbs, there are only so many possible variations on hunk of meat, piece of fish, egg, or things you can make from milk. Again, this is another parenthetical. She goes, it's not an accident that the northern reaches of Europe are little famed for culinary excellence.
That's not
or
true
that
at all.
The most interesting and appealing local specialties tend to be either cheeses or some kind of alcohol.
Those things are good.
Yeah, cheese and booze rule.
Yeah, cheese, booze, and bread are fantastic. Also, fucking watch Anthony Bourdain every once in a while. Go to, like, Denmark and be like, this is the best fucking meal I've ever had.
McArdle kind of, like, digests ideas like it's Jack in the Box. They're just in and they come out sort of fully formed, but in, like, a soupy shit that fills your toilet and leaves a permanent stain. It's like, she starts out by going, well, we can guess that Julius Caesar was known to eat spaghettis and meatballs and, you know, throw a big pizza pie in the air because empire is implicitly good, and that's why I supported the Iraq War, so we could get pizza, too. By the way, actually, he didn't have those, but, you know, you get my point. And it's like, what? I'm going to forget that in 10 minutes, but it will just leave a stain, a brown ring around my mind forever.
Let's flush again.
In your brain toilet.
Flush again the brain toilet. We're moving on to the next paragraph again. Ironically, the tenacity and abundance of Italian food culture may also be attributed... The tenacity and abundance.
Yo, you got to fail to succeed to have spaghetti, dude.
The audacity of...
All these haters try to... keep Italian food down.
It may also be attributable in part to the intense regional strife that followed the Roman Empire and the poverty of Italy's long decline from its Renaissance peak.
So
wait a minute.
So yeah. it is imperial hegemony and the opposite of that.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
As my colleague Tyler Cowan,
a fellow libertarian, another complete know-nothing shithead.
As my colleague Tyler Cowan at the George Mason School for Orphan Studies, Orphan Experimentation and Studies, has noted in his marvelous book, An Economist Gets Lunch, in place of Chapo readings, that's next up on the Chapo reading series.
Fuck you, no.
An economist
the
gets
the very
lunch.
Thought of reading that book.
He's just probably
I just got a headache.
He goes sorry, to I'm every pret a manger off the Acela.
Sorry, I'm clicking through the hyperlink to the book's page.
I will fucking kill myself if you do this, Will.
A leading economist.
I will fucking kill myself and you. I'm going to turn this fucking living room into the Benoit household if you buy that fucking book for us. No. Okay. No, can't keep getting away with this.
Okay, he goes. Tyler Cowan notices that in places that industrialized early, mass commercial canning and television preceded the technological and logistical innovations that made it easy for us to get decent produce year round. In those places, hungry and relatively poor people developed a taste, or at least tolerance, for bland processed food made palatable by lashings of sugar and fat. Then came television, which favored meals that can be eaten one-handed in front of a screen.
That's why she thinks food became...
This is Tyler. She's summarizing
his
thesis.
Because of TV, it was a response to TV. Mm-hmm.
No, that's why she thinks food got bad. So if your culture pre-existed and came before television and mass agriculture, you still have good food ways. And if you had it afterwards, then you're just used to shit and you're just watching TV and eating it.
Why do you need one hand to eat food while watching TV?
Because you're jerking off.
Unless you're jerking off. The price is right.
She also says, and women moving into the workforce, which favored anything that can be prepared quickly. Thanks to its relative poverty, Italy came to these things late and at a time when global food supply chains were improving. So Italians held on to a food culture that prized care and taste over efficiency and ability to withstand a harsh shipping process. All these things are probably part of the explanation, but they cannot be all of it. Because why, almost a century after the great wave of Italian immigration ended, are Italian Americans still noticeably better fed than, say, their Irish American counterparts?
I demand to see some sort of evidence for this! I mean, they're pretty fat, but we're all fucking fat.
We make jokes about, like, Irish food, but that's just because we don't like the people. If you go there, they have great bread. They have fantastic lamb. They have, like, five meals, but, like, they're a good five meals.
I demand, what is she talking about?
Like, watch this
scene. All of these are the most unprovable assertions in the history of the universe.
You know what? The problem is her race science is inaccurate race
That's
science.
That's right.
Yeah, not like us.
We keep it accurate.
She goes, boots on the ground race science.
As the anthropologists are fond of telling us, culture is a mystery. Is that what anthropologists tell us? That was the opposite of anthropology.
So anthropologists tell us, I quit. This is too hard.
This is like, Megan did two things while just mainlining ketamine and writing this article. She watched The Godfather, so she sees the scene where Clemenza's like, hey, you fucking pussy.
I'm gonna make
the meat sauce, you fucking Ivy League pussy. And then was like, oh, Italians have a great food culture. And then she watched the third Indiana Jones movie and was like, wow, he was an archaeologist all that time. Anthropologist, same thing. Just didn't know there was a Holy Grail. Yeah, those two ideas work together. Here's a column that I get paid $350,000 a year to write. Who knows what the fuck's going on in the world? Italians be having some food.
Anthropologists tell us that culture is the emergent sum of millions of individual decisions. So we cannot replicate Italian food culture. We can only try to figure out how to let as many people as possible free ride on their cultural labor. Okay. Here's where it gets really good.
Bitch.
This is where she begins proposing solutions.
Also, she's not making it at home.
And the other thing is that she's conflating Italian-American immigrants with Italians that throws the whole thing off and destroys her entire argument. No.
Yeah.
Okay, New York?
Yeah, she like eating like squid ink fucking pasta and shit.
She is literally Paulie Walnuts when he goes to Naples.
Yeah.
And he's like, can I get some gravy for this? So he goes, New York has more than its fair share of Italian cuisine. thank you. Perhaps some denizens of a town or neighborhood of a certifiably Italian-American character will take pity on more barren culinary climes. Again, McArdle grew up in New York. Little Italy is now two blocks downtown. Yeah.
And it's, you know what? I'm sorry. Good.
The rest of it
I like the Chinese food better.
It's just Chinatown. I don't like there. I mean, are there real Italian neighborhoods in New York?
No, not really.
Not really.
They're like
baby.
No, I will take you to a pork store. No, there are, but they're in outer boroughs.
Carroll Gardens in some place.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It's actually Bay Ridge, right?
The best fucking Italian place in New York, in my opinion, is in, I guess it's in Clinton Hill. Like, things matter around.
They're all over
the place. There's a ton of, actual Italian shit, upstate, too.
In Boston, which has the East End, and then in Rhode Island, which is, 90% WAP. Yeah.
There's a great Italian restaurant on the Pacific Garbage Barge.
Continuing.
There's a fantastic Italian.
It's a legitimate business.
There's a fantastic Italian restaurant operating out of Chris Christie's neck fold.
Oh my God, the bread.
You dip it in. Mangia.
I mean, his folds create a natural yeast that is just
abbondanza.
Of course, she continues. Of course, without a critical mass, the food culture will dissipate into a sea of Oreos and tater tot casseroles. So we need at least a few thousand.
I don't actually like either one.
We need at least a few thousand to move en masse. This is where it gets really interesting. Which reminds me, if only we could spread French cuisine the same way. But since America has pitifully few recent French immigrants, this may require some sort of special visa program.
Get a recipe.
These are the last three graphs. They're short, but this is where it gets truly special because Megan is proposing in her mind a solution to the completely made up problem of the not being enough Italian food
before
in America.
Before we can get to these last three paragraphs, I just want to say if you're easily offended or shocked, don't look at what I'm about to do to myself.
Sorry, excuse me. Here we go. Towns could even entice Italian food-related businesses with tax abatements and special grants enabling to relocate their linoleum, their mask cards, and their battered steel display cases to new homes within the great American food desert.
No. You put a tube of hair gel and a wife beater underneath a box with a stick on it, and you just wait till they wander in, and then you're like, you're starting a restaurant here.
Dying of opiate addiction, fucking catastrophic climate change and misery, and people are killing themselves all the time. And just all these small towns in Indiana, just the Rust Belt at large, are gonna be like, yeah, so we're going $3 billion into debt to get some prosciutto.
We began the episode talking about the terrible problem of healthcare and the lack of healthcare in this country, and Megan, I'm sure she's written about healthcare before, about how that's not actually a problem. She's written dozens of columns about why it's the lack of access. Everyone can just go to an emergency room.
Yeah.
In her mind, it's a lack of Italian delis in the great American food desert. There's a problem that the government, through tax abatements, what Stalin did to the nation of Chechnya during World War II, she wants to do with Italian neighborhoods on the East Coast and just put them on fucking cattle cars out to the great American food desert, as she describes it.
She wants to lure the Guidos.
She wants to lure them with tax abatements because she's a libertarian. She concludes by saying, this may seem a little extreme to you. Must thousands of our fellow citizens uproot themselves simply to improve the food culture elsewhere? To even ask such a question demonstrates how dire the problem is. If you cared about food properly, which is to say as much as Italians do, you'd already be recruiting in and around New York.
But she just, her whole part before that was about how culture is this mysterious web of a million things and how they're the result of when your mass culture interacts with agricultural innovations and canning and television.
I think you're uncharitably reading her interpretation of culture. I think she's saying it's that when the moon hits your eye, like a big pizza pie, that's amore, and that's just where you have to start if you want to start to, you know, study or spread this
stuff. Doesn't the government already have a program where they relocate strong, you know, very close, culinarily gifted Italian families to the Midwest under new names? I guess it doesn't work because...
Give me egg noodles and ketchup.
Yeah.
Ketchup! Ah!
Again, okay. So that's Megan Ricardo, literally the most pointless thing ever written.
I'm going insane to kill myself.
Insane idiocy.
However, I would like that there is like a nugget of something interesting there. The first layer is that this is what like people like Megan McArdle think are actual problems in America.
Yes.
She, like I said, we began this by introducing what she doesn't think is a problem is like a few hundred people dying in a deregulated fire trap, or let's say that millions of people don't have health care or can't afford it. That's not a problem to her.
Not really.
What is the fact that not enough people get excellent charcuterie in places with crack linoleum and mask cards on old-timey registers.
And that's just fetish. She's just fetishizing one place that she
However,
went.
However, what's also interesting is we've talked before about how conservatives have this idea about like unemployment and shit and like the problems with like economically depressed areas in America is that people should just move. But they also like wax on constantly about the importance of like community and like being rooted in a place and how important that is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I mean, who's to say what you should do?
Displacement is good for poor people, though.
Yeah. So, again, Megan just sort of like was like, boy, I like Italian food. Better write a column about it. And again, it's just like the grinding banality of her prose and the just sheer idiocy of her thought process really, I think, makes her one of a kind. And every show now will just be reading her columns.
Oh,
now.
Thank God.
Miners should learn to throw pizza.
Rip to me then, because I'm going to fucking die. I will die if you keep doing this.
Where's Felix? Where did Felix go?
He took a smoke.
Oh, wait. Felix is... he's hung himself from the bathroom. Oh, well. If you'd like to apply to be our replacement co-host for Felix, write to P.O. Box 42069 Penn Station, care of Large Sons Productions, LLC. Tim Faust, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I guess that wasn't really a pleasure, but in general, this is a pleasure.
Till next time. Mamma mia.
I'm walking in.
Manja.
In prison, dinner was always a big thing. We had a pasta course, and then we had a meat or a fish. Paulie did the prep work. He was doing a year for contempt, and he had this wonderful system for doing the garlic. He used a razor, and he used to slice it so thin that it used to liquefy in the pan with just a little oil. It was a very good system. Vinny was in charge of the tomato sauce.
Ah, got the smoke. That treat, the kinds of meat and meatballs.
What'd you put in there?
Veal, beef, and pork.
Ah, good, but you gotta have the pork.
Oh, that's the flavor.
I felt he used too many onions, but it was still a very good sauce.
Vinny, don't put too many onions in the sauce.
I didn't put too much onions three small onions, that's all I did.
Three onions? How many cans of tomatoes you put in there?
I put two big cans.
You don't need three onions.